All right, we left last class with John Hyrcanus. That's who we're at. So we got good old John Hyrcanus, who takes over the Hasmonean dynasty. Oh, that's a bad one. Going for the trash can. Did it go in?
Yeah.
Okay, there we go.
This is going to be a good class. I can feel it. John Hyrcanus.
Who did he take over for? Who was the previous Hasmonean leader? Simon. And what was Simon? What was Simon known for? What was his biggest strengths? Diplomacy. And what did Simon accomplish? Explain that to me. What did he accomplish? What did he do? Yep. Yes, he gets financial independence, some more political independence. But then he also strengthens ties with Rome as well as with the Seleucid Empire. And Simon, as opposed to his brother, but Simon is by the people appointed high priest and by the people appointed the military leader and by the people appointed the governor of the nation. What is the caveat for him having these positions? He will hold high priest until what? A prophet comes and tells them what to do otherwise. Initially, that's a good idea, and it doesn't go well. Simon's killed in 135 because of his son-in-law Ptolemy, tries to go after him. Eventually, John Hyrcanus comes to power. Okay, John Hyrcanus immediately tries to expand the empire to the size of David, going south and then going up into Samaria, having a lot of successes. In some sense, they even looked at John Hyrcanus' beginning reign as what? A golden age. This is what we were hoping for, to restore the kingdom back to the time of David. And then things start to get a little shaky. What is the group that he has some conflict with? The Hasidim. The Hasidim. And we gave a very specific and vague definition of this group. And what is it? Yeah, they're a religiously fervent group. They are constantly focusing and thinking about religiously fervent, how is it we're going to restore things back to its religious purity, the Hasidim. Now, the problem with John Hyrcanus is that even though he is taking all the positions that Simon had, he is not of the Davidic lineage, so he doesn't have claim to be king, because he is not of the throne of David. And number two, he's not of the Zadokite lineage, and yet he is king and priest, right? So the Hasidim have a problem with this. As a matter of fact, there was supposed to be whenever a prophet came to give some sort of instruction, but what does John Hyrcanus also claim to be? A prophet as well. Matter of fact, that's even how Josephus refers to him in the first century. He says, no, he was able to even do things like tell the future. Well, now if you have the prophet, priest, and king, but they are not of the lineage that's the correct lineage, the Hasidim have a problem. They say, if you truly are a prophet, then why don't you give us a word about how to restore the positions back to their purity instead of keeping them for yourself? You see what they're asking? So this relationship is strained, and he has a banquet to help out their relationship. And what do the Hasidim ask him? About his mother. Hey, wasn't your mom held in captivity by the Seleucid Empire? And what's the veiled reference? What are they veiled saying to him? Are you a bastard child? Are you an illegitimate child? Because if your mom was held in captivity, you know what happens to women held in captivity. You see what they're poking at? Oh, and that riles up John Hyrcanus, and he immediately severs the relationship with this group. From this group comes the Pharisees. So, remember, we're asking this story before the story for what purpose? So that we can understand what? Yeah, the Gospels. Remember, we talked about it at the very beginning, about 10 class periods ago. All the different things that have changed. What are the different things from the Old Testament to the New Testament that have changed? What stuff? Pharisees, Sadducees, they exist. The Herodians exist. Where'd they all come from? The synagogues. A more developed belief in the resurrection. Angelology, demonology, Satanology. Eschatology as a whole. Change, yeah, go ahead.
Rome,
yeah, the change of superpower. change of language from Hebrew Aramaic to Greek. Now, at this point, hopefully, now as we're recounting this list that we said at the beginning, hopefully you're able to start making some ties with what we've gone over the last 10 weeks of going, okay, well, now that makes sense why that is there. This is the big players this moment. Pharisees come out of this, but also a group of religiously concerned people, some of which could be a part of the Hasidim, although that's a little bit hard to establish. But they start to align themselves with John Hyrcanus, and they are known as the Sadducees. So remember, we talked about the end of last class. I told you I was going to recount this and we were going to build on it a little more. We have the Pharisees and Sadducees. You learned this in Acts class. They contrast themselves. They contrast each other. I mean, I guess they contrast themselves too, but they contrast each other. You have the Pharisees. Where is their locus of power? Where is their primary power and influence? Pharisees. In Jerusalem or outside of Jerusalem? Pharisees. Outside. Yeah, we flipped a coin. Outside. Synagogues. That's their primary area of power. Whereas the Sadducees, their primary area of power is in Jerusalem in the temple. Right? Now, it doesn't mean that they both don't have the Sanhedrin. That's a compromise inside of Jerusalem. But if you're talking about the actual power of the Pharisees, they're amongst the people outside of Jerusalem, which makes sense with the way they're going to be treated by John Hyrcanus and the people that follow. They're going to be also a more theologically conservative or liberal group. What are they considered? The Pharisees, sorry. Liberal. Although I understand how it can be considered conservative, but we'll get to that in a bit. But liberal in the sense of they add oral tradition, they add all of the Old Testament. Now, actually, this is why the words conservative and liberal are also ones I can't wait for eventually to go away. And it's simply because they're doing that out of conservative motivation. They're adding in order to be more conservative. But adding can also look quite liberal. Does that make sense? Sadducees look conservative, although they're doing it for liberal motivations. Look conservative because they reject oral tradition. They reject every book of the Old Testament except for the first five books, the Pentateuch. And we talked about that. What is the advantage of only being beheld to the Pentateuch? Yeah, the lineage now is no longer a problem. Lineage isn't a problem for John Hyrcanus because David doesn't come in the first five books of the Old Testament. You don't have Zadok in the first five books of the Old Testament. That's gone. So the Sadducees make a theological commitment that helps support a political move, which is the other way they contrast. Sadducees politically are considered very liberal in the sense that they are in cahoots with pretty much anybody that's in power in order to advance their agenda. And the Pharisees usually have a very strained relationship with the positions of power, if a relationship at all. Okay? It all comes from this moment. It all comes from this tension that's been building. They wanted the Hasmoneans to restore the people back to what they were before the exile. But when the Hasmoneans gained power, they did not easily let it go. And that causes some fissures, some crevices, cracks inside of the people of God. And another group comes about. During this time as well, the Essenes begin to develop. So we don't just have the Pharisees and the Sadducees, but the Essenes. And the Essenes basically say this. They say, you're all corrupt. Pharisees, Sadducees, Hasmoneans, this is a joke. And they decide to completely move away from all of the people of Israel, all the Hasmoneans have built, and into what we eventually refer to as the Qumran community. The Dead Sea Scrolls, that type of stuff. The Essenes, they move away. Yes. Essenes. The Essenes. And you can see why this would be a legitimate option. One of the things that's pretty fascinating, and we'll talk about this more in the Messianic expectations, in the Essenes, they are very, but their whole point is whenever God comes back, he decides to return in the sense of his glory to Israel. He needs to find a pure people. And so we will pull ourselves away and we will make sure that we are purified so when he comes back, he actually has someone. Because everything that the Hasidim was and now everything that Hasmoneans were, that is obviously shown to be corrupt. We will be the pure people. And a lot of the key motif inside of the Dead Sea Scrolls is this figure that comes back as the archetypal king and priest. It's called the diachronic. We'll look at this later. The diachronic messianic expectation of a king-priest is not something that you find in the Old Testament robustly. It is present, but you have to read into it more than it is like, oh no, this will be a king and priest. It's not everywhere. It's not robust. It's not fully developed. This is something that develops more thoroughly in the Essenes. Why is that? Well, because they're responding to what it is that is the problem. Is this making sense? What they then are writing about and celebrating and articulating is in some sense a direct response to the perversion that the Hasmonean dynasty has become. So from this tension, we have three groups developing in around, you know, anywhere from 130 to 104. That's the time period we're in. That's when John Hyrcanus will reign from 134 BCE to 104. Okay? And it's during this time period that we have these three groups starting to emerge. So by the time Jesus comes on the scene, these three groups, especially the Pharisees and Sadducees, have been at odds for about 100, 150 years. And the more that they articulate their positions that has a lot to do with their political affiliation, the more that they become entrenched in their debates. This is the reason why Paul, knowing the debate that goes back at this point almost 200 years, can be inside of the Sanhedrin and lob the bomb of the resurrection in the middle of them, and they are at each other's throats to the point where Paul has to be rescued yet another time. Where does that come from? This. And the reason why the intensity of these groups will escalate is because of what happens after John dies. Okay? Is this making sense, though, this origin story? John dies in 104. It's pretty unceremonious. We're not going to really go into it. He's dead. Okay? When he dies, Aristobulus takes over. Aristobulus reigns for 1 year, from 104 to 103. And Aristobulus, he continues the expansion as far as of the land. He actually, if we have our map here, and remember Jerusalem's down here, the first move of John Hyrcanus was to go down to Idumea, to go south. Then he goes up to Samaria. Aristobulus will continue to move up here, which is, you know, it is and is developing as the region of Galilee. So he begins expanding up here. Again, he's only reigning a year. He is known, though, for loving Greek culture, which that's not a good sign. He's known for loving Greek culture. He forcibly claims the title of king, which is not... Remember, you had Simon was appointed by the people as king. But now this guy, he's just like, no, you're going to call me king whether you like it or not. He's cruel to his own family in order to secure power. He's vicious to his family, which eventually leads to his downfall. Which, we're not going to go into... the details of these don't matter for what it is we're going after, and that is the story behind the story. So 103, he's, let's just say, disposed of. He's dead. Then comes Alexander Janius. Alexander, you can spell that. Janius. I feel like I'm missing an A. I am. There's an A right here. J-A-N-N-A-E-U-S. Alexander Janius. He reigns from 103 to 76. So a lot longer than Aristobulus. He marries Aristobulus's widow, which that's pretty typical, especially in kind of the Jew with Levirate marriages and things of that nature. But he marries Aristobulus's widow, which that will be important here in a moment. But Alexander Janius, in some ways, he's even worse than Aristobulus. He loves Greek culture as well. Pretty big Hellenizer. As far as military-wise, he actually has a lot more of his conflicts down in Egypt. not necessarily because he was successfully expanding, but because they were just in conflict, more foreign conflicts. Which, if you have foreign conflicts, that's going to weaken what it is you're trying to accomplish here. And that will be important, because in 76, because he's spending so much time in foreign conflict, it's actually going to open the door for this to be taken away. But that's building. So, foreign conflict, domestic conflict with the Pharisees. Back home, he's in big conflict with the Pharisees, to the point where there are reports that Alexander Janius crucifies 800 Pharisees at one time. Which, again, the Sadducees would have been involved in the support of a movement by Alexander Janius against the Pharisees, crucifying, mocking, humiliating them. And we're talking only 75 years, maybe 100 years before Jesus will be crucified. The tension between the Pharisees and Sadducees goes deep. Does that make sense? Yes?
Are they called Pharisees at this time?
That's highly debated. It's highly debated. As a matter of fact, even the origin from directly the Hasidim, which is the position I take, that's highly debated, which is natural. They come from somewhere. I think that what is a fair way of saying it, it's a polyvalent. There's multiple ways and multiple layers to how they eventually emerged, what it is in the first century. But what I'm giving you is more of the two-dimensional, because that's what we need to do. Does that make sense? But were they called it? No, it's not that they weren't. It's just not that they were. I don't know if that makes sense or it's helpful, but it's true. Anyway, okay. So he crucifies 800. Morally and religiously, Alexander Janius is everything that the Maccabees had fought against. He's everything that they had fought against. And you're talking within 80 years of the abomination of desolation in 167, whenever they've gained all of this religious and political independence, Alexander Janius, morally and religiously, is everything the Maccabees fought against. Which is a bit of a bummer. Then the next ruler is Salome Alexandra. What do you notice about that name? It's a female. Alexandra. This. Oh, I didn't know this year. It's 76 to 67. She will reign, for around 9 years. This is the widow of Aristobulus that married Alexander Janius, that once he dies in 76, she actually becomes the ruler. Which is the gasps and the it's appropriate. This is pretty unprecedented. And yet, many of the rabbis, so coming out of the Pharisees, many of the rabbis, not just Pharisees, but many of the rabbis refer to her reign as the golden age of the Maccabeans, which is pretty fascinating. She controls the country. Now, the Pharisees control her. So the Pharisees feel like, okay, we were just 800 of us were crucified under the previous guy. Now under her, there is a benevolence, a compassion towards her that they feel, hey, this is a golden age because we now have some power. It's fascinating, though, because her two sons, and these two sons, their names will be important because of what happens next. She has a son, Hyrcanus II. You're going to get quite a little bit of that. Oh, there, that's an N, I promise. Hyrcanus II. And you're also, I believe it's Aristobulus II. Yeah, Aristobulus II. So, really creative names. Aristobulus II. I'll move this out of the way a little further so you can see. Her two sons, Hyrcanus II, he was the high priest and had the support of the Pharisees. Hyrcanus II. He is the high priest during her reign and has the support of the Pharisees. Religious affiliation from the Pharisees to Hyrcanus, which is a big deal for the Pharisees since they felt like they were an outsider religiously. However, Aristobulus II ran the military and he had the support of the Sadducees. Which is why the rabbis would have looked at her time period as a golden age. She's able, through her sons, to unify what it was that was fragmenting. So Hyrcanus II has the support of the Pharisees as the high priest. Aristobulus II runs the military and has the support of the Sadducees. Okay, makes sense so far? I know we're going through this part quick, but I'm actually needing to go through this quick so we can get to something that's going to be very important. Okay. When she dies, there's civil war between these two. When she dies, their getting alongness, it breaks, it fragments. Civil war breaks out. Which, again, you have Pharisees then supporting one side and Sadducees supporting the other. So civil war breaks out. Long story short, Aristobulus II wins-ish. And when I mean ish, it doesn't, because he wins, it doesn't mean Hyrcanus II is killed. But Aristobulus II is considered the one that reigns from 67 to 63, although it's a time period of constant fighting and trying to preserve his power. But Aristobulus II, he defeats Hyrcanus. Hyrcanus, though, he finds an ally that will be a player. He finds an ally from Idumea by the name of Antipater. If you know where our Herodians come from, this is during 67 to 63, because that's whenever Aristobulus II reigns. So Hyrcanus develops during this war with his brother. He develops a not just a friendship, but an alliance with Antipater II that's from Idumea, that's from the south. Now, they're not effective enough to actually overthrow Aristobulus, but they do unite. Okay? Meanwhile, Rome is rising. If anybody took my Roman history course this past semester, you'd realize the dates that we're about ready to move into for Rome are enormous, very important. 63 is the time when the first triumvirate is about to develop, with Pompey and with Crassus and with Julius Caesar. And Julius Caesar will die on the Ides of March in 44. So we're coming up. We're within 10, 15 years of Rome solidifying its power. About 30 years away from whenever the Second Triumvirate will be broken up and Octavian, otherwise known as Augustus, will take power. 31, Battle of Actium. So just to give you an idea of where Rome's at and their history, they are rising. They're about ready to hit their pinnacle within 30 years. Okay? And that's important because of what happens next. Rome has been systematically advancing east. Remember, Rome, we're talking, man, about at this point 100 years earlier, had kind of solidified Egypt, had solidified, you know, Greece and Macedonia and Asia Minor, but was systematically moving this way. No major surges. They were fueling through alliances, the revolts of the Hasmoneans, all that stuff. Now, they're ready to seize all the way up the east, all the way over to Judea. They're ready. And a guy by the name of Pompey, who in Roman history is a pretty significant figure, Pompey, he has been moving this direction, and he sends his official, I'm not going to tell you his name because it doesn't matter and it's hard to spell. But he sends his officer down into the Syrian Empire to see who it is that he can find alliance or what it is the situation is so as to know best how Rome can subjugate it. So he sends down an official and says, I need you to figure out the terrain. I need you to figure out how we can exploit this situation for the benefit of Rome. That's his task, okay? So Pompey sends him down. Hyrcanus and Antipater, as well as Aristobulus, are jockeying for position for Rome. They both go and they offer huge sums of money to this Roman official, saying, if you align with us, we will give you this, and we will be on your side, and we will fight for your agenda. And the Roman official decides that he thinks it's best for Rome to align himself with Aristobulus II. Yes? This is in around 63-ish. And I say ish because 63 is a big date, but we're building up to that. Okay? So it's around that time. So anywhere from 67 to 63, because that's when Aristobulus is reigning. Okay? The second is reigning. So the Roman official decides that it is Aristobulus the second that's the best person to be in alliance with. All right? In 63, now this is a firm date. Okay? In 63, Pompey is now in Damascus. So up north, he's in Damascus, which is in the region. And what you have, it's actually the very northern part of the region, which is, well, that's the book of Acts. I can't talk about that. Although Acts chapter 8 and Acts chapter 9 are interesting why they go, because it spans the whole region, but that's another different point. Okay. In 63, Pompey's up in Damascus, and three Jewish factions go up to him to try to secure. Now, the Roman official comes back and says, I think we should do Aristobulus the second. But he's just doing field work. Now they will go up and make their official pitches to Pompey. Okay? So you have Aristobulus goes up, and at this point he is the front runner because of the Roman official's assessment. You have Hyrcanus and Antipater go up to try to win Aristobulus's affection, or not Aristobulus, Pompey's affection. Then finally, you have a third group that comes from the Hasidim, so kind of a Pharisee-type movement, that comes up to Pompey asking him to obliterate all the Hasmoneans and to restore the temple system they had before the exile. That was their request. Restore the high priest back to Zadok. Restore us back to a temple-based system. So you have two that are fighting for the position of Rome, and then you have one that's asking Rome to obliterate everything and let them go back to a system that they were before. At first, based off of his Roman official's recommendation, Pompey is on the side of Aristobulus. That's how it begins. But then Aristobulus starts to act kind of funky. He starts getting real defensive. Even at one point during these negotiations, he even retreats all the way back down to Jerusalem, and the Romans say that he's not just back in Jerusalem, but he's even hunkering down inside of a citadel as if he's ready for war. And Pompey's like, man, I'm not messing with this. So Pompey decides to actually reject Aristobulus and to align himself with Hyrcanus. So Pompey then starts coming down south to Jerusalem, knowing that Aristobulus is hunkered down, that Hyrcanus is going to be the one that is Pompey's going to align himself with. Hyrcanus decides to open the doors of Jerusalem and let Pompey and all the Roman soldiers in, thinking that it was going to be this grand entrance of Rome's alliance and of Hyrcanus now rising up to the king, the regent king of Rome, vice regent king of Rome. Instead, Hyrcanus opens the doors, and Pompey comes in with his soldiers and starts slaughtering Jews. Slaughtering Jews, which kind of reminds you of what Menelaus ends up doing at a certain point. It reminds you of stuff that Antiochus Epiphany does, because Pompey doesn't just slaughter Jews. As a matter of fact, the accounts from Josephus and others say that the priests were in the middle of their sacrifices, and as they were being cut down, they were still trying to fulfill their priestly duties. But then Pompey also demands to not just capture the temple, but to actually enter the Holy of Holies. And he does. Which again, reminds you of everything that happened pre-Hasmonean. Now this is very important because this is a key indication of the Roman interaction with the Jewish people. This is at the very beginning. That what's happening is Pompey says, I don't just want to be in alliance with you, I want to own you. Walking into the Holy of Holies, fascinatingly enough, Josephus says that Pompey goes into the Holy of Holies and he sees nothing. Which is weird, because what should be there? The Ark of the Covenant. There's a lot of conjecture of where it is, obviously even still today, which is kind of fun, but a little ridiculous. But one of the things that's fascinating is that Pompey in 63 reveals that the Ark of the Covenant is not where it should be. And therefore, part of the question is, did it ever even come back from exile? Which is pretty startling to think that every year the high priest would walk into the Holy of Holies to offer sacrifices of atonement, and he would know the big secret, that the Ark of the Covenant, which represents God's presence, is not with the people of Israel. It's not with the nation. It's not with the Hasmoneans. It is not there. Pompey goes in, sees this. This reminds them of Antiochus Epiphanes. The Jewish people then, as a whole, have an initial disposition of anti-Roman. They are already at odds, which is kind of an important component once we get to the New Testament. At this point, Judea is actually reduced down to a Roman state. They're under the control of the Romans. They are subjugated again. Everything the Hasmoneans were moving towards, in the blink of an eye, is wiped out. And as a matter of fact, all of the outlying territories that they had gained, Rome says they are now ours. So anything that you did moving down into Idumea, anything that you moved up in Samaria or even into Galilee, that now belongs to Rome. It is no longer yours. They also now were subjected to pay a tribute. The Judean state had to pay a tax to Rome. Remember, that was a big deal with the Seleucids. And one of the things that was even accomplished not too long ago was to get out from underneath a taxation, gaining political independence. The yoke of the Gentiles had been cast off. And now the yoke of the Gentiles has been added back on. But these Gentiles are way more vicious and way more powerful. Hyrcanus is confirmed, though, as high priest. But there is no king. Rome is your king. That's very clear in Pompey's new situation. You can have a high priest, and that's who I would direct with. Now, the high priest will be chosen by Rome. But you have no king. You do not get that title anymore. That belongs to Rome. So, everything, there is no more freedom. Yeah, they can have religious freedom, but it's still with the hands of Rome in it. It's not of the Zadokite lineage. We have a deep, deep, really, dissension back into, or descent back into what it was during the time of the exile under the Romans, which is one of those misnomers that we almost think, wow, you know, they were in exile, but then they came out of it, and now they're fine. This is, I agree with N.T. Wright on this. It's going, no, from the Jewish perspective, the exile has never ended. Rome was not the end of an exile. It was the perpetuation of one because of the way that Rome even parallels Antiochus himself. Over the next 20 years, so this isn't around 63, the next 20 years, 30 years or so, you have a lot of different people attempting to vie for control over Judea. It is in Rome's control, but the problem is that Rome is about ready to descend into a time of its own chaos. Why? Because you have the first triumvirate with Pompey and Julius Caesar and Crassus. They are fighting for control over all of the empire. Julius Caesar will arise, but he will overextend, and within 5 to 7 years, Julius Caesar will be killed by the Senate. Then you have a second triumvirate that arises, and they're fighting for power. As you're having internal power struggles, what happens is the edges of the empire, they slide in and out of your control. That's a very normal thing. If you're internally struggling, then the edges of your power become a little bit more blurred. So over the next 20 to 30 years, you see this movement of belonging to Rome, but other people kind of taking it over and not taking it over. And finally, in 37, so you're talking 6 years before the Battle of Actium, in 37, an Idumean, so coming from the south, an Idumean, by the name of Herod, who will eventually be known as Herod the Great, he besieges Jerusalem. Now, why would Idumea want to come after Jerusalem? Well, because whenever John Hyrcanus, just 60, 70 years earlier, came to power, first thing he did was go after Idumea. So Idumea comes up, they siege Jerusalem, and in 37, with the help of the Romans, because the Romans are trying to find whoever they can to bring stability to the region, with the help of the Romans, after 3 months, Jerusalem fell into the hands of Herod the Great. The last of the Hasmonean leaders was sent to Rome in chains and later beheaded. Therefore, in 37, with the ascending of Herod the Great, the Hasmonean dynasty is no more. It is over. Okay? So, why is that Herod piece really important? Well, who else comes on the scene in the New Testament we've not really seen before? The Herodians. But they also come. This is why the Herodian relationship with the Sadducees, whenever you see Jesus there and you have Herodians, Pharisees, and Sadducees coming against Jesus, that's pretty startling if you know their recent history. For these three groups to unify against anyone means this person is a major threat to something they all value. Because a Herodian, I mean, my goodness, even if you're a Sadducee, you have a hard time with the Herodians. Because the Sadducees were deeply aligned with John Hyrcanus and with the Hasmoneans, sure. But a Herodian? One that comes in with the help of Rome and besieges Jerusalem, overthrows the city, and then hands it to Rome and allows the key leader of the Hasmoneans to be beheaded? And you're going to align with that group? It's whenever you have a common enemy, it shouldn't shock you whenever deep enemies are able to unite. This is why, and some of you at this point, you just don't have as clear of a memory about this, but because you were barely alive. But at 9/11, there was a startling couple of months after 9/11. For the next couple of months, I remember this weird moment where you were seeing Democrats and Republicans standing on the steps of the Capitol building in Washington, D.C., united in responding to what it was that has happened in 9/11. And pretty much every action over the next, really, I would say 9-10 months, every action that President Bush suggested to do, both sides unanimously were okay with it. I mean, that's whenever a lot of the Patriot Act stuff was passed, a lot of the different, you know, interrogation techniques that have come under big fire, as they should, over the last 10 years. A lot of that, though, was passed in the 9 months that followed after. Why? Because when you have a common enemy, even enemies will unite. So when you see the Pharisees, Sadducees, and Herodians coming together against Jesus, don't be lost on the fact that he must be a significant threat to something. Because these three groups are not going to unite easily unless it's something on the level of a 9/11 that's occurring. There is a major threat that's happening. Now, will they, in the midst of the uniting against an enemy, at times still be fighting with each other and jockeying for position? Absolutely. No question. But I mean, even think about Paul in the book of Acts. Pharisees and Sadducees uniting at times as long as they could to go after this guy. Until he brings up the resurrection and they can't help themselves and they go after each other's throats. Kind of forget who they are for a moment. Or remember who they are for a moment, I guess. That's probably a better way of saying that. But when the Herodians are coming to power, they're not coming to power in some sort of benevolence. They're coming to power united with Rome and besieging Jerusalem, similar to what all of these superpowers have done before. Is this making sense? The tension in the first century amongst the Jewish people has been festering for hundreds of years. And you see it come out, and ultimately you see it even, I think, come to a breaking point in the crucifixion of Jesus. He becomes their scapegoat in a unique way. And they're looking for one. Any society that's at its throat eventually needs some sort of scapegoat in order for normalcy to come back to. If they don't find the scapegoat, then the society will devour itself. This happens in every society. This is the work of René Girard. You have to have somebody to blame. Otherwise, you will devour yourself. It breaks to a boiling point. And that's what you see happening in the first century. Especially whenever Jesus is out in the wilderness preaching things like the kingdom of heaven has come. Is this making sense? Why this story before the story is so important? When you're reading through your book, you're going to see new colors jump out, new debates differently. You cannot read dietary law debates or Sabbath debates the same after knowing this. It had to do with the only way they could preserve their identity in the middle of an exile. You will not read Jesus walking into the temple and throwing over tables and ending sacrifice, at least for a couple of hours, the same way whenever you're reading this. I mean, Jesus walking into, now he doesn't walk into the Holy of Holies, but when he starts going in there, ceasing sacrifices by throwing over all the tables, it's a reminder of an Antiochus or a Pompey move. it doesn't, it shouldn't surprise us that it's that action that within several days after that, he's crucified. They're not going to tolerate this. It also shouldn't surprise us when a Barabbas, who is a convicted murderer in an uprising, a political insurrection, is the one they want to have let go instead of Jesus, who merely overthrew temple tables. Why? Because Barabbas looks a lot more about the agenda of the... It's the reason why they come and ask Jesus the question, should we pay taxes to Caesar? What are taxes throughout the story before the story? Evidence of exile. Subjugation. And Rome is the new one that has subjugated them. You will not read the same. Savior. The word means something different when you have this story before the story. You will not read John 6 the same. We want to make you king of the earth. You will not read Jesus' even rejection of titles of king, or even Peter's great confession the same. We think you are the Christ, the king, the anointed one that's come to liberate us. Jesus says, you're right, let me be crucified. You're not going to get crucified, Jesus. Where is this coming from? This. You will not read Jesus' words as playful, cheery, and always just filled with love and compassion that makes people feel good inside. For the stuff that Jesus is preaching is threatening to everyone. You will not read Jesus' healing of the Roman centurion's servant the same if you're looking at the eyes of any one of these people. That is scandalous. Or Jesus says, love your enemies or turn the other cheek. You do not see that narrative played out in the last 500-600 years. The way you overthrow Babylon is you get a Judas Maccabeus. You don't love them. You don't turn your cheek to them. Even the crucifixion, if you're a Pharisee, you look at it different, knowing that just 100 years earlier, some of the people that you came in their lineage were crucified. The New Testament cannot be read the same if you truly take this seriously, which is the reason why we spent the first 4 weeks on it. All right, no class tomorrow. Love you guys. See you on Tuesday. Oral exam.